I heard once that August was supposed to be a slow news month. Whatever happened with that anyway? From American Public Media, this is MarketFlex. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday it is today. This one is the 12th of August. Glad, as always, you could be with us, everybody. Yes, I know this is not your typical August, and it is certainly not your typical election. So we're just going to run with it. Here to dissect the 5 days gone by are Kathryn Rampell from The Washington Post, John Carney from The Wall Street Journal. They are both in our studios in New York. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Kathryn, obviously the big economic news of the week, the two speeches from Mr. Trump and Secretary Clinton. I was struck, and I would be curious to get your feedback about the differing ways those speeches tell us about the candidate's economic policy. Mr. Trump, broad brushstrokes at best. Secretary Clinton, virtually a bulletized line item speech.
I agree with that to an extent. I think that Hillary Clinton's speech was very much a political speech, though. It wasn't so much laying out new policy. She summarized a lot of the policies that she has already presented, some in depth, some in less depth, over the last few months. But it was a political speech. You know, she was trying to contrast her vision with Trump's, her personality with Trump's. A lot of the speech was dedicated to talking about how he had, you know, reportedly shafted lots of workers and contractors, how he wasn't in favor of the little guy, in her words. So, yes, there was a laundry list of policy requests, but I think she spun it a little bit differently than that.
John, your sense?
I thought that I agreed with you in that I did think she tried to have a lot more policies that she was going to talk about. And I think that was actually part of the intentional contrast with Trump. Trump did, you know, try to talk, you know, big picture and didn't have, you know, promise lots of details on his website later. But and so I think Clinton was trying to say, I'm really different than that guy.
Yeah, for a speech that Mr. Trump had promised us would be the detail speech, he said we'll have the details in a couple of weeks a whole bunch of times. Kathryn, Trump talked about bringing back coal and steel jobs. Secretary Clinton talked about, and she was standing at a high-tech manufacturing place. She talked about advanced manufacturing in this country. This is going to sound pejorative, but it's not meant to be. Mr. Trump seems to be looking backwards economically, Secretary Clinton, to the future.
Well, they were. We should also know that both speeches were in Michigan, and I'm sure that's no accident, right? Yep. There are a lot of manufacturing workers there who have been laid off, who are looking for the next thing, who are hoping that their jobs will come back in some form or another. I do think that there's a pretty interesting, nuanced contrast between what Trump was offering and what Hillary Clinton was offering, and that Trump basically is saying we're going to turn it back to the good old days when you had, lots of subsectors of manufacturing here that have since gone abroad or have been automated virtually out of need for labor or need for similar amounts of labor. Mm-hmm. And Hillary Clinton was instead talking about, well, we need to be thinking about clean energy manufacturing, advanced manufacturing, the cutting edge, which, you know, in my view, I think is a bit more forward-looking, but it also kind of glosses over the fact that those kinds of jobs are probably not going to call for the same types of skills that laid-off manufacturing workers have. So it's not clear that actually the people who are expressing so much frustration in this election about their economic situation, about being laid off, are actually going to benefit as much as a lot of sort of the new class of workers.
And there will not be, John, as many of those new manufacturing jobs as there were that it took to mine the coal or you know, make the steel. I mean, you had a whole riff on productivity and what kinds of jobs we're going to have.
That's right. If you think about it, one of the things that we just saw this week was that the productivity of the American worker actually fell for the third quarter in a row. That hasn't happened since the 1970s. It's very bad. You need productivity to increase if people are going to be better off in the future than they are today. And one of the reasons for that is that a lot of the jobs people have taken in this recovery just produce a lot less value in the economy than the jobs they had beforehand. And specifically, manufacturing and mining are some of the most productive jobs that you can have in the economy, which is why, even though they were emphasizing different kinds of manufacturing, both of them are saying they want manufacturing. And I would put a little different spin. Trump is saying, like, look, we have guys who used to build stuff here. If we can bring those jobs back, then, you know, those guys can do those jobs again. Hillary Clinton's talking a little bit science fiction. These are jobs that don't exist and that we don't know necessarily will exist. You know, how many clean energy people, you know, do we really need? What kind of degree do you have to have to be able to successfully manufacture a solar panel that can sit on a car?
And we just don't know and won't know for a while. John Carney at The Wall Street Journal, Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Guy.
Have a great weekend.
All right. You too, John. Wall Street, and Catherine too. On Wall Street today, we're still dancing around those 1999 record highs. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. With Congress having gone on summer vacation without funding the fight against the Zika virus, the Obama administration has been reduced to the political equivalent of scrounging under the couch cushions for change. The Department of Health and Human Services is pulling in a little cash from here, a little cash from there, from programs that research cancer and diabetes, and from the fund that helps poor people buy heating fuel in the winter. Altogether, the administration has scraped together about $81 million, which sounds like a lot, but given the potential scale of the problem, really isn't. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein looks at where exactly those relative pennies are going to go.
For one of the guys leading the Zika fight, it's been a pretty good day.
I'm going to be $34 million better off than I was yesterday.
Dr. Anthony Fauci is at the National Institutes of Health. NIH is getting almost half of the money the administration has scraped together. It'll be plowed into clinics from Brazil to Florida to set up operations to test an NIH homebrewed vaccine.
We have to hire nurses, get the materials there, start enrolling the individuals so that as soon as the beginning of 2017 comes, we can hit the ground running.
Fauci's in a hurry because there are more than 7,000 Zika cases reported already in the U.S., most in Puerto Rico. It's not just the government that's getting money. $47 million is going to private companies. Dr. Richard Hatchett is at the agency that will hand out that money to five different drug makers.
To make sure that you end up at the end of the day with a vaccine that has been licensed by FDA, you've got to take a lot of shots on goal.
Researchers think there's a good chance they'll get the ball in. Dr. Dan Baruch at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston has teamed up with Walter Reed. He says they've three great leads.
All of these vaccines in both mice and monkeys provided complete protection against exposure. The protection was striking.
Here's the problem. The money for the vaccines is only going to last about 6 weeks. So the next question is, can the administration get Congress to keep up the funding? I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
An update now on fracking, specifically the risks and the benefits of that controversial technology. No easy thing to do in 2 minutes, but here goes. One of, if not the key concerns about hydraulic fracturing, as it's properly known, is whether alongside all the oil and natural gas that it produces, whether fracking pollutes local water supplies. Last year, the Environmental Protection Agency issued a draft report suggesting a very limited risk of that pollution. Now, though, the agency's own science advisors are taking issue with that conclusion. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong is on that one.
The EPA study in question began with this press release. Hydraulic fracturing activities have not led to widespread systemic impacts. Every newspaper ran with it, that it's safe. Oil and gas companies crowed. Now that conclusion is challenged by science advisors as confusing, as not quantitative. It doesn't define widespread or systemic. Here's EPA advisor John Vina at a webcast meeting.
I think it's a value statement that's not based on the science.
Vina's an epidemiologist at the Medical University of South Carolina. He wonders if the EPA even has the data to make such a blanket statement. The industry was stingy with data for the study, which itself cites insufficient data.
So I look at the sampling that was done. It was two states and 300 or some wells. It's very difficult for me to extrapolate that to the entire country.
There is suspicion politics hijacked the science. Curiously, that press release got buried in the web archive soon after release. Hugh McMillan at the Anti-Fracking Food and Water Watch notes that this EPA is part of an administration that is pro-natural gas.
EPA was not clear where the science ended and where the political considerations began.
The next step for the agency is to take this feedback and revise its fracking study. The question is where this leaves the public. Rob Jackson at Stanford has done a lot of fracking studies, and his take is that it's safe most of the time, but not always.
We need to understand the relatively few cases, but not the inconsequential cases of things getting into people's water. We haven't still learned enough about that.
Perhaps an unsatisfying answer to a politically charged question. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Clogged streets are a headache from Shanghai to Cairo and points in between. In the Lebanese capital city of Beirut, things are so bad that the government there has had to get help from the World Bank. Hundreds of millions of dollars have been promised to replace Beirut's bus system, which apparently operates without timetables or bus stops. In the meanwhile, locals, well, they've had to adapt. The BBC's Hugo Goodrich reports from Beirut.
This is the soundtrack of Beirut. A cacophony of engines and horns, many of which are frequently at a standstill due to crippling traffic problems. 10 years ago, a study by the Ministry of Environment found the cost of urban congestion to be around 8% of GDP, when the problem wasn't as bad as it is today. In an effort to solve this problem, the World Bank is stepping in with a $200 million plan.
My name is Ziad Nakat. I'm a senior transport specialist with the World Bank, based here in Beirut. The idea is to introduce a fast, affordable, and reliable public transport network for the greater Beirut area with extensions to the regions. So the project will have three components. The first one, which is the backbone of the project, is bus rapid transit, which is basically buses on dedicated lanes. The second component of the project will be regular bus lines, or what you call regular or feeder lines. And the last component is really about technical assistance and building the capacity and the planning and management of public transport.
In Lebanon, people are used to improvising when the government doesn't provide solutions. Most recently, people are using bicycles to get around the traffic. Zaina Howard is one of the city's avid cyclists.
It's not as scary as people say it is. It's convenient, it's fast. The city isn't that big, so it's just very quick to get around by bike. It's congested during the week for most of the day, so getting around by car is like really annoying and impossible. Cycling isn't ever going to actually like catch on unless the city starts investing in infrastructure or trying to like create a culture slowly.
As the cycling population has risen, so has the number of businesses built around cycling. Karim Sokan is the owner of Cycling Circle and Dugri Messengers, both based in the capital city, Beirut.
I've established my bike touring company in July 2012. It's basically a cycling business related to tourism on bicycle. 1 year after that, I've created the first bike messenger service in Lebanon and the region. People are shifting generally in Lebanon now towards the green alternatives.
With the backing of the World Bank, the completion of a bus rapid transport system in Beirut looks promising. And as the Lebanese economy continues to feel the strain, it can't come soon enough. But until then, Lebanese drivers are going to have to keep leaning on that horn.
The BBC's, there's the horn, the BBC's Hugo Goodrich in Beirut. Coming up,
cappuccino, peanut butter pretzel, sweet cream, strawberry cheesecake, and Thai tea.
Tasty, right? But I hear you asking, what are those tasty flavors of? Oh, I'll tell you. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 37 points today, 0.2%, 18,576. The NASDAQ gained 4 points, about a 10th percent, 5232. The S&P 500 down a point, less than a 10th percent, 21.84. For the week gone by, the Dow and the NASDAQ up 0.2 percent, the S&P 500 up a 10th percent. Some department stores moved up despite lackluster retail sales figures from the Commerce Department today. JCPenney rolled up 6.1% percent as it reported better sales and a smaller second quarter loss, always good. Nordstrom moved north 8% after posting better than expected earnings and raising its profit guidance for the year. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.51%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Global trade has been something of a theme on the program this week, what with the election having brought us those two big economic policy speeches that Catherine and John and I were talking about. China has figured prominently in a mostly unflattering light, but here's the thing, the context. Trade between the world's biggest economies has for years relied on a convenient status quo. American companies employing hundreds of millions of low-wage Chinese workers to make products that got shipped back here for American consumers to buy. But that trend is turning around as the balance in the global economy changes. Big Chinese companies are setting up factories here, providing jobs for American workers. And nowhere is this more evident, reports Marketplace's Rob Schmitz, than in South Carolina.
1960s South Carolina, a state where African Americans fought for the right to attend white-only schools, restaurants, bowling alleys, a state where the National Guard attacked and killed protesters who were fighting for these rights. South Carolina Secretary of Commerce Bobby Hitt says that era's turmoil had a serious impact on business.
So I think the sense was it was hard to recruit American companies into South Carolina because of these parochial attitudes. And so I think the strategy started to emerge, well, if we can't sell to our local national audience, maybe we should go overseas.
South Carolina did just that. Plants owned by BMW, Mercedes-Benz, and Volvo have made the state the largest exporter of cars in the U.S. Foreign tire makers like Michelin and GT have made the state the largest tire producer in the nation. South Carolina now leads the country in foreign direct investment, much of that in the form of Chinese-owned factories like this one. A machine grinds spirals into high-performance drill bits on an assembly line in the small town of Seneca in upstate South Carolina. Once finished, they'll be shipped to customers throughout North America and Europe. 10 years ago, this factory was run by Greenfield Industries, an American drill bit company. Then the recession hit, says Operations Vice President Bobby Densmore.
It looked more like the building wasn't even open. The property wasn't taken as good care of. The grass was head high. People thought we had closed.
In 2009, Chinese company Top Eastern, the world's largest drill company, bought Greenfield. The new Chinese managers went on a hiring spree. They cut the grass, and in an overgrown plot of company land once used by employees as an ad hoc driving range, it built its global headquarters.
So you've had, over the last 5 years, you've had various levels of construction going on. You've had new jobs come in. And so now it's, we're a driving force in the community.
Densmore estimates the Chinese takeover of this factory added 200 jobs to a community of 8,000 residents suffering from the recession. They're positions that pay an average of $16 an hour, and like most jobs in South Carolina, they're non-union, one of several things that have attracted other Chinese companies like Haier, the world's largest appliance maker, to build factories here.
We are a low-cost community in a low-cost state.
Richard Blackwell is executive director of the Oconee Economic Alliance, an organization that aims to attract investment to Oconee County in upstate South Carolina.
We have a lot of economic development incentives that brings that burden, if you want to call it, that cost burden down even further. And, we've proven that global companies can be successful here.
Oconee County lowers property taxes for outside investors, and the state of South Carolina, says Commerce Secretary Bobby Hitt, offers another incentive.
We offset most of their income taxes with credits. We want our companies to be profitable, because if they're profitable, they're going to grow and add more employees. I mean, it's a pretty straight-up formula.
A formula that's put nearly 3,000 South Carolinians to work manufacturing products for Chinese companies, giving a new meaning to the term outsourcing. In South Carolina, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
There are few things better on a hot summer day than a nice big cone full of soft serve ice cream. And that gets us to today's installment of our series, Summer, brought to you by a mom and pop soft serve ice cream shop with a twist.
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
Rose and Warren Schwartz opened up Magpie's Soft Serve a month or two ago, not far from downtown L.A. I stopped by on my way home the other day.
I don't know. Can we go in the back bank?
Yeah.
Why do you have an oven?
Oh, toppings. I make all the toppings here.
Wow. How's the soft serve business these days?
It's pretty good. We were lucky opening up in the middle of summer.
Smart. Not lucky, smart. How did you come to this point of, what we ought to do is open a soft serve ice cream place?
Well, originally we wanted to open up just hard ice cream by scoop. But then we realized in LA there's awesome ice cream everywhere you look.
Yeah.
You know, it's saturated. So we were out on vacation and we decided to walk into a Dairy Queen just to get some soft serve. And we walked in and we're like, no one does chef flavors, chef driven soft serve.
So what you're doing here really is sort of craft brewed soft serve ice cream.
Yep. That's exactly what we're doing. And we started doing some R&D. We got ourselves a little Taylor machine, stuck it in the house, and started off with, you know, buying milk and cream and just going making bases.
None of this powder stuff?
No. We never...
Ooh, you look horrified.
No. We actually did do a little R&D with powder stuff and then quickly realized that it just tastes horrible.
So let's talk flavors here, right? I mean, there's a half a dozen, you know, 8 or 10 on the board out there. Run me through them.
We have malted milk chocolate, corn almond, cappuccino, peanut butter pretzel, sweet cream, strawberry cheesecake, and Thai tea.
Thai tea and a soft serve ice cream?
Yes.
What's your best seller?
Probably the chocolate, the malted milk chocolate and the sweet cream, just because all the kids come in, they either went white or brown, and so that really moves it. But the corn almond... We knew we'd hit on something. Rose had made of this batch of corn almonds.
So is it like almond milk almonds?
Yeah,
is
that what... exactly.
Okay,
yeah.
So ew, but that's just me.
No,
I'm just saying.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
We'll convert you when you go out there.
But I don't know.
We knew we had something. At this point, we have two little boys, 4 and 5. And we would, you know, do our testing with the boys. So we figured, you know, the kids' palate, you know, they eat it no matter what it is. And Wes, I handed it to Wesley, and I was expecting him to, like, as a 5-year-old do, go yuck and... And he grabbed it, and he like pulled it to his chest. He goes, "I'm keeping this one." And I went,
Could you give me the not a recipe, but the how you came up with the formula for making soft serve in a non-powdered yet scalable, business-friendly kind of way?
Well, that was actually very tricky because you can't find any recipes on soft serve anywhere. The tricky part was actually the sugar part because my palate, I don't like excessively sweet things.
Yeah, but you're making ice cream.
And that was the tricky part, because sugar acts as the antifreeze in soft serve. If you put too little in there, it's not going to come out of the machine. It'll freeze, and it'll turn the gears and make this awful noise. And that was the tricky part. And then I realized I need to add more sugar in this.
From the time you guys walked into that Dairy Queen on vacation or whatever it was, to the time you opened the doors a month ago, how long did it take?
2 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah, 2 years.
We're very fortunate. People love soft serve, and we're connecting. But the hard part was getting these doors open and not going terribly over budget and wasting money and time. And
You look a little fatigued.
There were some challenging moments. I mean, when Rose and I looked at each other, go, what in the world are we doing? You know, we had to set up to get another loan just in case, because we ate into our operating capital. And we were just lucky that it connected right away. And so,
all right, you gotta sell me on the corn almond.
Let's do it.
That's because I'm a non-believer. But okay.
All right.
So looks like vanilla, but whatever.
You would never think it was non-dairy.
No, you would never think it was non-dairy. All right, that's not bad. And you know what's funny? The difference between this and powdered soft serve, right? Regular like Dairy Queen soft serve. It's really thick.
Mm-hmm.
It's really thick. Which has to be
it's the overrun. We don't add that much air into it, so you have a denser product.
There's like chemistry in here, man.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much.
Seriously, that corn almond was pretty good. We took some pictures while we were there as well. Marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today, Hillary Clinton released her 2015 tax returns today, from which we learned the speaking and writing business can be lucrative. Both the former Secretary of State and her husband listed speaking and writing in the occupation box of their married, filing jointly 1040. Business income was a hair over $10 million. They gave $1,042,000 to charity, a cool million of that to the Clinton Family Foundation. Their effective tax rate was 34% last year. From Donald Trump's tax returns, meanwhile, we learned that... Oh. Wait, Never mind. All right, we are out of here on a Friday. The Dow off 37 points today, 0.2%. The NASDAQ up 4, about 0.1%. The S&P 500 down a single point less, obviously, than 0.1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president around here. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you next week, everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM.